Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course. Present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is! Drawing Board or...
Miro! All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
They say I'm disturbed.
From city to city, an incredible hysterical panic spread.
I think we're getting into a weird area here.
Will you tell these fools I'm not crazy?
This hysteria.
You can't handle the truth. Truth.
Brain is gone.
This is Hysteria 51.
We're here.
The truth is out there.
It's alive.
But you won't find it here.
They're coming for you. Look, there comes one of them now.
Welcome in, Hysteria Nation, to the podcast that's never owned a space pen. But we did have this other pen growing up. It had a girl on it. You could twist the cover. Never mind.
Mine you had to turn upside down real quick just for authenticity. So just letting you know.
This, whether you like it or not, is Hysteria 51.
No one wants to hear about your formative years. This isn't a horror podcast.
That is a scary thought.
Brent's formative years. That should be my new podcast, John.
He annoys me in so many ways.
What are you talking about? Me or him? Now I'm confused.
It's not a Freudian slip, like a Freudian inference.
Go on.
We are broadcasting from the lower fourth dimension, otherwise known as Chicago. My name is John Goforth, and here alongside to give you a verbal hug are the smooth stylings of Mr. Brent Hand.
Not really sure how I feel about that phrasing, but I'll let it go. No, I'll accept that.
Know what gives me a verbal hug?
Ugh, don't say it.
Delicious soup.
Well, I guess even old robots can learn new tricks.
Covered in cheese muffins.
I retract my former statement. Anyway, Brent, we have another author interview this evening. But first, before we get to him, it brings to mind a question. We're always talking about authors that we like and who we might want to have on the show. If you could interview any author, living or dead, who would you pick and why?
I can get you a dead author by 2 p.m.
No, Seba, that's not what he meant. Go back to your beer. You see, I've actually found that I have to actually tell him no to every stupid thing he says. Otherwise, he takes a lack of response as consent.
You mean it isn't?
I am not touching that with a 10-foot pole. Anyway.
Keep him away from college campuses.
I don't know. That's a hard one. If I could talk to anyone, I guess maybe Poe, and then I'd pop him in the mouth for making so many emo people through the years.
That's the thing, though. He was truly dark. He wasn't
right.
He wasn't doing it. Wasn't some affectation for him.
Well, and I watched this documentary, and it turns out that him and Abraham Lincoln fought vampires together. I don't know if you know that or not. So.
Oh, yes. I saw the same documentary. It was great.
Yeah. It was on PBS Plus. I don't know. Do you have one? Like, do you have a strong opinion on that?
I'd have to give it a lot of thought to who could you wring the most knowledge out of or whatever. But just off the cuff. I think Mark Twain would be fascinating. Every great quote is Mark Twain. And such a good author, such an interesting guy. And when you read some of the interviews from him of the time, it seems like if nothing else, it would be a really fun and interesting conversation.
Yeah, and he'd use, fun little weird southern 1800s dialect and stuff like that.
And
so
anecdotes and yeah
right, I guess would be the way to say it. I don't know, some of them might be a little but they're probably fun for them for the most part.
I mean, I hope he turns out to be a blinding racist or something.
I declare also.
Let's hope he was progressive. The other one that comes to mind that, you know, I don't, here's the thing. It's so hard to know who would actually be fascinating to talk to versus who was a good writer for what they did.
Right. We've talked to people and we've heard of people that talk to people that are amazing writers that then you talk to them and they're, well, some people are locked in themselves. Some people are antisocial. Some people can write the things they can't say. This is not per se our experiences, you know, but, you don't know what you're going to get, so to speak.
Yeah, that's right.
Almost like a box of chocolates, John. Yeah. See what I did there?
I do know what you did there. I agree with that. Another one that comes to mind for me that I really like his writing. I like a lot of the quotes that come from his writing. And then he's a poet. Robert Frost. Mm-hmm. My favorite quote in the world comes from a poem of his, A Servant to Servants. And that's the best way out is always through.
Mm.
I love that quote. I've been a big fan of that for a long time. I'm also, you know, who isn't a fan of the Road Not Taken, you know, and that made all the difference or whatever, you know, that quote. That he was such a wise man, or at least comes across that way.
Yeah, right.
You might meet him. He's like, what? Hey, gosh.
Maybe so.
I mean, I don't fucking know. But, you know, that would, I think, meeting someone like that could also, they say, you know, don't meet your heroes. It could also really suck.
Right. Like, well, oh, absolutely. God,
this guy was a nincompoop.
Yeah.
Or, you know, this guy was an asshole or, you know, whatever.
Yeah. You know, people come across one way and then are very different sometimes in life. So don't meet your heroes.
You and I both went with dead folks. Living, I think Stephen King would be really interesting to sit down and talk with.
Well, if you're sitting home and screaming Martin Keller, you're in luck because he's on the show today. Or I guess we're in luck because we got to
I'm
do it.
I'm guessing at least 25% of the audience was doing that very thing, Brent.
Well, this is actually a really great book. I enjoyed it. And he's, you know, I'm really looking forward to talking to him. We are talking the Space Pen Club. Now, I'm going to tell the full title here. Deep breath. The Space Pen Club, Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, UFO Disclosure, Consciousness, and Other Mind Zoomers. It's a mouthful. That's the second line.
That is a mouthful.
Yeah. So here's a quote from the author before we get him on here. The Space Pen Club is written as much for those who know very little about the perplexing subject as it is for those with a deep interest, including the various researchers, debunkers, and disinformation agents, and media and government figures with whom I traveled along this cluttered cosmic highway. But it also features close encounters with other phenomena and topics, including quantum entanglement, synchronicity, the tarot, electromagnetic low-frequency weapons, crop circles, stigmata, remote viewing, precognition, conspiracy bots, Fisher Space Pen technology, and the star knowledge of the Lakota, Sioux, and other First Nation tribes. Now, I might have thrown a little bit in there. Could have been the Lakota Sioux part, could have been a different other part that wasn't actually part of it.
There was one other piece. Yeah, I'm not sure.
The thing I think I dig is the approach of lumping so much together and seeing how it applies to humanity itself. He kind of did like this, this isn't the way I would say it, but it was almost like a guerrilla tactic. He was in this forever. And then he wrote the story about his experience in it, kind of like a Hunter S. Thompson. Well, I experienced it in order to be able to write about the UFO phenomena. He lived it for several decades. It would be one way to put it.
That's why I did all those drugs. Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
And, you know, he's also a former pop culture journalist, and he's an unproduced screenplay writer. We all have that in us. Yeah. His work has appeared, though, in Rolling Stone, Leaders, The Washington Post, the Boston Globe, Final Frontier, Billboard, Right On, the Star Tribune, Minneapolis St. Paul Business Journal, City Pages, and others. And then he's had appearances on Today, 48 Hours, PBS, Public Radio, and more importantly, and he's going to have to update his bio now, Hysteria 51.
That's right. So we are going to talk to the man, the myth, the legend himself. But we got to pay the bills first, Brent.
Yeah, so we're going to go to break. And when we come back, we're going to talk to, as we said, Martin Keller, who's spent the last 25 years working in this crazy world of the unknown, so to speak, and his book, The Spaceman Club, which is out now. So that's coming up next after the break on Hysteria 51. Hola, David. Me amo Brent.
Bonjour, Brent. Je m'appelle David.
You didn't do Spanish. I thought if we were going to do this together, we'd do the same language.
Oh, sorry.
That's on brand for us.
I just thought romance languages was the key.
Everything I say is romantic, and that is thanks to Rosetta Stone. You guys, we've been touting these things forever. We love Rosetta Stone, and we actually are users. David, you've really been using it even for longer than I. What's your experience been like?
Oh, it's been great. The thing is, you really get to learn how to speak and think in that language with it. So it's very high on pronunciation too. So you can, you know, learn how to speak.
And you know, our show is all about proper pronunciation.
In that pronunciation. Yeah, that's right. But they designed it for long-term retention, you know? If you don't get the pronunciation right, you say it until you do. And then, you know, that just seeps into your head.
Well, and that's why, you know, this has been trusted by experts for 30 years, and there's over 25 different languages that you can learn, and people, millions and millions of users use it because, like you said, it does seep in and you're using it with, you know, you get speech recognition and it hears you. You get to use like the built-in true accent features that gives you this pronunciation, which is super convenient, and you can do it at your own time. And I don't know if you know this, but I'm all about value, and you get a one-time purchase, 25 languages. If I learned all 25 languages, I'd be so confused. Or really cool. I'd go in and out.
But you'd be real marketable.
But literally, though, this is something that we use, and we have, both of us have given the seal of approval because we want to do this long term, and it's something that it works, you know, and we don't do long term stuff like this, and this is the one that we've chosen, and we love it. So all you guys got to do, don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now, as we've told you 1,000 times, and it's always now. Right now. Get now. Started. For a very limited time, Hysteria 51 listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off.
How much?
50%. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your unnatural life.
Wow.
Redeem, redeem, redeem. How do they do it?
Rachete, you're 50% off. Rachete. Redeem it. 50% off, rosettastone.com/today. Do it today.
Nation, we are back. And as we told you before that little journey through commercial land, we have a special guest. Joining us this evening is none other than the author, Mr. Martin Keller.
The Space Pen Club. Not a club that I'm in. I'm kind of upset about that, Martin.
You might be surprised when a lot of people discover what the club is about. They realize they've been members for years.
Well, I was just good. That's where I wanted to start out. Tell everyone listening about the Space Pen Club and how you fell into this.
Well, the Space Pen Club is an actual club that started in my collegiate years in central Minnesota. And one of my classmates who was working at the bookstore found a Fisher Space Pen, was pretty intrigued by it, and brought it back to the dorms, and everyone kind of, the first pen to write in space. You know, astronauts have used it.
I can write upside down.
It writes underwater, yeah. It writes across Greece. It's a high-tech, highly engineered pen. The company's been around for about 60 years. You get all kinds of different models of space pens. The pen really represented, I think, to the club members, personal exploration, cosmic consciousness and communication, transcendence, and the occasional quest for girls' tunage and controlled substances.
We were college kids. Yeah. I love you even have pictures of you guys from back then in the book.
Yeah, that's fun stuff. There's over 70 pictures from those festivities, Peak with the Leaves and Rites of Spring. But, you know, the founder, Denny Lynch, who sadly is no longer with us, he really thought the pen represented possibilities. the reason I named the book that is because, well, the subtitle number one is Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, UFO Disclosure, Consciousness, and Other Mind Zoomers. The reason I named the book that is because a book about UFOs is really about, this book in particular, is really about the possibilities of what the world of you of acknowledging UFOs or ETs or whatever these things are, what the possibilities are for the planet. And I think that's a one of the major themes that runs through the book.
Well, I think it's an important time too. It's coming out of the great time. Look at what's going on in the news right now, and for better or for worse, the word disclosure gets thrown about a lot, and we could talk about that after a while, but at least the cultural, it's in the cultural zeitgeist, you know, and it might be being overlooked, but at least people are being given the word UFOs and UAPs and phenomena like that with their normal news now, which is something that a few years ago would never have happened.
Yeah, it's, you know, I couldn't have planned this if I were in charge of anything. The timing has been impeccable.
So you didn't get a shield check to put this out, is what you're saying?
What's that?
I said you didn't get a shield check to put this out. Is that what you're saying?
Right, exactly. I'm really working for the government. But no, I've been accused of that, by the way. But, you know, it took me about 10 years to write this book. And I put it aside for 2 years for various personal and professional reasons. So if it had come out 2 years earlier, I'd be playing catch up with the news cycle, because the media coverage on the run up to this government report from the Pentagon and the Director of Intelligence that landed on June 25th, it was a tsunami. Mm-hmm. And there's still widespread interest. While the report was kind of a dud, and we can probably get into that later, I think the best thing to come out of it is that the media now is taking this very seriously. The public, who I think is in front of this, of the media and the government, you know, most people believe UFOs are real, and a lot of people believe they've ETs have visited or are surveilling the planet. So, yeah, it's just impeccable time for a book like this to come out.
Well, Martin, my dad used to say, and I'm sure he didn't originate this, but my, you know, it's better to, I'd rather be lucky than good. And but luckily you're both here. You were lucky in the timing, and the book is good. So tell us a little bit more specifically about the book. We understand the origin of the Space Pen Club, but you know, it sounds like that was the touchstone for which you go off into numerous directions. Tell us more about, if we go out and buy the book, what we'll be reading.
Well, the book is really an insider's tale, and that's yet another subhead on the book, an insider's tale, a personal odyssey. It really goes deep into the what Dr. Stephen Greer at the Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence, or CSETI, used to call the UFO ghetto, the UFO subculture. Mm-hmm. I was Greer's publicist for about 5 or 6 years in the 90s. And, it really, you know, this book touches on everything from so-called abductions. You meet debunkers who've been in the community UFO world for years. It looks at the secrecy, the how and the why. You know, you'll also meet some astronauts. As a kid, I was a huge space geek. I wrote to NASA, and they sent me autographed pictures of all the astronauts from the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo programs.
That's awesome.
I ended up meeting Ed Mitchell and spending quite a bit of time with him, because he aligned himself with CSETI at one point. So you're going to meet astronauts. You're going to meet some Native American medicine men who started the Star Knowledge Conference in South Dakota on a reservation. So there's a lot of storytelling going on here. There's a lot of narrative threads, and it's a pretty engaging story.
Before we lose that thread, before we move on, you mentioned Stephen Greer. You said you worked with him for a while in the 90s. Obviously, a lot's happened involving Stephen Greer, you know, over the course of time, from the earlier disclosure stuff he was doing, the big event, to some of the documentaries that he's put together. And to say he's a polarizing figure in the ufology world is to understate it, to say the least. I'd love to get your take on today, as we take the totality of the work of Dr. Greer. Are you a fan? You know, he's made a lot of bold claims. What's your overall takeaway there?
Well, a couple things. First, I met Greer originally as a freelance journalist. I ended up spending some time with him in LA and then later in Colorado at the International Association of New Science, which is no longer around. It's a very interesting nonprofit. And I thought almost immediately, this guy is a pariah. And fast forward 30 years, he still is. Or maybe for different reasons than the ones I perceived back in the 90s.
One of the things you said in the book that, and this is completely paraphrasing because I can't remember how you said it, but it was that he's such a polarizing person that people either absolutely hate him or think he like walks on water, so to speak.
That's exactly right. And, you know, the truth is generally always in the middle when you have those two types of extremes. But the thing that intrigued me about Greer and still does was his whole Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind initiative, the CE5 initiative, and the contact protocols he had developed. I was interested in UFOs for a long time as a kid and had sightings in high school with some high school buddies. And once I went to college, I didn't think twice about him. But when I was approached to maybe interview him for a magazine article, I said, yeah, that sounds interesting. You know, I haven't thought about this subject in 20 years. And the more I talk with him, the more I realize that, you know, this might be the next wave in ufology or this whole thing. He dwells on the whole imperative of consciousness discussion. And that intrigued the hell out of me. And the book at one level kind of threads through different viewpoints on consciousness and what the implications are. So, I mean, I was intrigued by those things with Greer. Now, I know Stephen has made a lot of missteps. He's a human being. I'm surprised he's kept out at it this long. He's virtually invested his entire life on this after a really pretty astonishing medical career that he gave up. So, as I explained to a friend from the club the other day, you know, Greer's intentions are good. I think they're pure. But his warts are the wartiest. And I point a few of those out in the book. And people who follow ufology will know that he's currently on the outs with Danny Sheehan over his latest film, Cosmic Hoax, for putting words in the mouth of Sheehan that apparently weren't there originally. So it's that's probably a little too inside baseball for Hysteria 51, but maybe not.
Something that you said that I've heard from a lot of people is you talked about you were kind of in the UFO closet for a while. And I can completely understand that. And we've talked to a lot of people that are scientists or pilots or whatever they are and feel the same way. What brought you out, so to speak? Was there an aha moment or was it just, I've gotten older, I don't care, I just want to be in this? What was your journey?
Well, before I met Greer, a good 6 months or more before I met Greer, I started experiencing some high strangeness in my home with my girlfriend at the time, who is now my wife of 27 years, Susan. Lights coming on that we had turned off consistently. And then one night, not only were the lights on, but there were sounds associated with the lights being on, like cat rutting. Really, really strange animal-like sounds. And we always said, like, why didn't you turn the lights off last night? Well, I did. You must have turned them on. No, I didn't. And, this went on for about a month. And then I started having a series of really interesting dreams, if they were dreams. And those are outlined pretty heavily in the book. The thing that sealed it, though, is in May of that year, I think it was 1990, I had a dream where I was in a harbor city that I didn't recognize, and a flying bus and it comes flying over the bay, and down in the water there's a collapsed pier and it's smoldering. You know, it's like a little white smoke coming up out of it, and I thought, man, this was a really lucid, you know, visual dream. I'm kind of a power dreamer. I usually remember one or two dreams per night. Yeah, but this dream had such great detail, you know, especially a flying bus, which I later learned is his masked imagery for flying saucers. 6 weeks later, I'm in Boston with my parents, taking my dad to Fenway because he was a lifelong Red Sox fan and had never been to the Green Monster. So I'm walking over to meet them at their hotel the first day of the games. And I'm walking over this footbridge, and I stop and I look across the harbor, and this is the exact same scene that I saw in my dream 6 weeks ago in Minneapolis. So precognition, you know, I stood there probably 20 minutes with my mouth open, like, what the hell is going on? Do I need to seek a mental health help here? Or, and then, you know, I kind of, in the book, I replay, like, well, all the things that led up to this moment on the footbridge. And then I go off to the baseball game. But very interesting arc, if you will, of finding out about the non-locality of consciousness. In other words, your awareness can be in two places at once. I can be sleeping in Minneapolis, but I'm really locked on consciously to this Boston Harbor scene. Of course, when I actually realized that standing on that footbridge in Boston, there was no flying bus, which is probably a good thing, but there was the collapsed pier.
When you had the dream, were you reflective on it, or did seeing it in real life bring it back to you?
I reflected on it pretty heavily because of all the weird stuff that was going on in the house. I also had a series of dreams prior to the precognitive dream about the newspaper hitting the front steps at home, and I would start reading the headlines, and then my ego state would shut that down, like, no, the paper's not even here yet, you can't do this. But that was a reoccurring dream, and looking back on it and reflecting on it, as you say, it almost seemed like I was being instructed somehow in consciousness. So when I meet Steve Greer, you know, I obviously tell him all this stuff as a preface, thinking he doesn't think I'm some kind of flake from the land of 10,000 lakes, you know, from Minnesota. A little smile crossed his face, and he said, well, you know, a good part of my lecture is all about the non-locality of consciousness and how consciousness is the imperative and the equal footing that sentient beings share, including that with the ETs. I mean, it's fascinating stuff. Greer's probably one of the most brilliant people I've ever met, certainly a visionary, but as I said, his warts are the wartiest.
It's an interesting thing, the idea of consciousness, because it's something that science can't explain away. The experiences you have are real because you've had them, and other people can say, well, I don't believe you, but that doesn't change if it happened or not. And so that's one of the reasons why I think a lot of people don't come forward, is the worry of being told, I don't believe you, or you're a liar, or it will follow them into their everyday life if they're X, Y, and Z, you know, who knows what they do for a living. So it is an interesting and almost... It's off-putting to think that people can't be honest and tell about these things and then have it researched in a scientific manner because of the stigma.
Well, and the fun part is, now obviously this hasn't been proven out, but as we advance in science and we start to see things like, oh, I'm forgetting the term, where a proton across the universe is connected to the proton here, and they can observe that. And, you know, one starts rotating one way and the other one starts rotating in the same way.
Yeah, that's quantum action.
Quantum action. Thank you.
What Einstein called spooky action at a distance.
And yes.
He was intrigued by this. I also think it scared the hell out of him because he didn't know how to think about it.
How to explain it, right. While there's no scientific breakthrough that has linked these things, that certainly does pose an interesting question around the ability of consciousness not to be rooted in one place, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think we're just in our infancy on the whole science of consciousness thing. Dr. Ed Mitchell, the Apollo astronaut that I met, sixth guy to walk on the moon, he had a major epiphany coming back from the moon where he felt like the whole universe was alive and that everything was connected. He went on to create the Noetic Foundation, which whose sole mission really was to study consciousness. And a lot of good work has come out of that institution with different academics. I have to share a spoiler here in the book. We're at a conference that C. SETI had organized in putting together their first disclosure effort in 1997. We're on the West Coast. We've flown in a couple Russian generals who are privy to UFO events in their country. And Ed Mitchell is there along with Brian O'Leary, who was slated for the early Mars missions until NASA scrubbed that program for, I don't think they've ever really established why they did that, other than probably they thought they weren't going to get funding for it.
Budget. Yeah.
Yeah, probably budgeting. NASA's all about budget, number one. But Brian O'Leary and Ed Mitchell are just kind of talking casually during these discussions, which were all filmed and were going to be used in the Project Starlight disclosure effort, best available evidence, et cetera, et cetera. And they're talking casually, and Ed says to Brian, you know, the whole Einstein's theory of relativity will never be disproven or advanced until they introduce the integer of consciousness into that equation, that famous equation of Einstein's. And these guys are talking about it like, you know, what do you want for lunch, a sandwich or Chinese? And I'm thinking, you know, I'm sitting off to the side going, man, is it too late to get in a time machine and go back and change my English major to astrophysics? You know,
man, right?
Conversations like that, that would be so much fun to be a fly on the wall. Mm-hmm. I always thought the same thing about the lunch that allegedly happened with Enrico Fermi. You know, kind of where the Fermi paradox came right. from, yep. where all, you know, all these scientists are sitting around shooting the shit, eating a ham sandwich. And, you know, he poses this. If that lunch happened, man, I would like to have been there.
I was exposed to a lot of conversations like that, and many of them are recollected in the book. Some of them right down to the verbiage used. So, you know, there's lots of layers in the book. I guess the reason, I think you asked me earlier, Brent, why now did I come out with this and write this? It's, you know, it's something I felt that, number one, I had to get it off my chest. Mm-hmm. Number two, I'm getting up in years. I wanted to get this down on paper, if for no other reason than that my kids and siblings, some of whom are terribly skeptic on this topic, could read one day and say, wow, what the hell happened to that guy?
Right.
You know, I had these collections of experiences and encounters, and then this odyssey through the C. SETI years, and now into the what looks like we're on the doorstep of government disclosure. So the book goes from, you know, my high school years until the present day. In fact, I was revising chapter 10 right up until publication day.
I think it was you were writing in May or something. I was going to say there was dates in there from this year. Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of pushing for disclosure, you brought up the Starlight Coalition. You were pushing for disclosure then with President Clinton. And in fact, you and Greer and many other people were the ones that had signed that paper that went to his desk saying, tell us what's going on. Can you sum up Starlight Coalition in a few words? Probably not, but
well, I'll try. Right. I tend to be long-winded.
That's what we're here for it.
The Starlight Coalition was a group of interested people and organizations. The people that signed that letter to Clinton included Jesse Marsall Jr., whose father was at Roswell, and I think, you know, got played 10 days to Sunday on what really happened there. Other folks included Kent Jeffries, who had done a lot of subsequent Roswell research, Ed Mitchell, the astronaut, Bootsy Galbraith, and Sandra Wright, who were friends with Lawrence Rockefeller, and they got Lawrence to write the check for this project and for the Asilomar conference that I just talked about earlier. Who else was involved in that? A friend of mine, Kevin Foley, who had done advance work for the Clinton-Gore campaigns, was pretty well connected in Washington. he was part of that. You know, it was about a dozen people, including some CSETI members like Steve's right-hand person, Sherry Adamack. We started out collecting the best available evidence, photographs, testimony from pilots, people from agencies who were willing to risk their pensions, because at this point there was no whistleblower protection. This is like 96, 97.
And this is right when all the lawsuits were coming out with Area 51 and the burning of the materials and things. There was no protection, none whatsoever.
So, you know, these witnesses were taking a huge risk. They all signed legal affidavits saying that their testimony is true. Bob Dean was part of that. Sergeant Major Dean, who pretty much made a career out of talking about the assessment, some document he had read in the early 60s, late 50s, that's pretty much said, yeah, ET civilizations have been visiting us for who knows how long, probably since the planet began to evolve with conscious life forms. And, you know, it changed his life. He made, you know, he made a career out of it on the saucer circuit, as I like to call it. So those were the kind of folks involved. That disclosure effort was pretty minuscule compared to the one that Greer launched at the National Press Club in, I think it was 2001.
Yeah.
And by then I had washed out of CSETI for a lot of reasons, mostly because I had a growing family and I needed to make a more decent living. You know, there was no paid position at CSETI. I got my expenses covered for travel and phone calls and stuff like that. But I always lobbied. I said, you know, go out and fundraise for, you know, so you can keep me on at what I do. Because I'm, all things considered, I turned out to be a pretty good publicist, just as I was a pretty good journalist. So,
following along those lines, you've also influenced a lot of people across ufology, both names that are known and names that are unknown. And one of the names that is known is one of the folks that said some really nice things about this book, and that's none other than Mr. Dan Aykroyd.
Danny.
Yeah, wonderful quote from him about some of the content of the book, and really just nice words. Obviously, we've talked about him on the show before. He's pretty vocal about his beliefs in ufology, and you know, obviously, he's got the vodka brand as well. Having read that quote, I was curious if you know him personally, if you guys have had discussions about this stuff.
Well, number one, it was a very generous quote, and it's quoted at length in the book's website at thespacepenclub.com. The whole quote is there from Dan. Well, almost the whole quote. There's a couple lines we edited out. I don't know if we want to talk about that or not. It's kind of humorous, but again, it's really inside baseball.
Oh, yeah. We'd love to hear that. All absolutely.
Right, all right. I'll get to it in a second. Just remind me if I forget.
Okay. All right.
There's a short quote on the cover of the book by Dan. And, you know, Mr. Aykroyd's been in this game probably as long as I have. He's a lifer. He's obviously always been interested in the paranormal. He's produced a bunch of different shows on that. You know, he's no stranger to the topic. In fact, he comes out in his longer endorsement of the book and says, you know, in addition to being a great read and accusing me of obsessing over some of the details in the book, he said, this book also functioned as a great bibliography because I hope I've cited some of the really great important research that has been done by other ufologists and people interested in topic. I don't really know Aykroyd personally, but we have a mutual R&B band that we both love called the Lamont Cranston Band. They're from Minneapolis. The Cranstons, this is a little known fact, were asked to be the backing band for the Blues Brothers when they blew up. They were going to go on tour, and the Cranstons unfortunately said no.
Wow.
A missed opportunity. I'm sure there's some big regrets there, but these guys were pretty hot back in the day in the 80s. And Aykroyd's always been a big fan, and he's still personally in touch with Pat Hayes, the leader of the group who plays guitar and harmonica. And their road manager, Rico Anderson, I knew was in touch with Aykroyd's camp. He's living back in Canada now. So I approached Rico last fall. I said, hey, I got this book that's going to come out. Do you think Aykroyd would take a look at it and write an introduction or an endorsement for it? He says, well, let's send it up the line and see what happens. So I sent them the manuscript in November. I did a heavy revision of it this spring, especially chapters 9 and 10, because there was so much news breaking around it. And
sure.
I had done some more thinking on it. But in March, I got this fabulous endorsement from Dan Aykroyd. And he said, I really enjoyed the manuscript and use this quote and however, whatever channels you want to use it in. So we've been leveraging that pretty heavily. The funny thing that he wrote at the end of it is that I'm putting this manuscript on the top of my shelf next to the Look magazine cover of Liz Taylor that features the Barney and Betty Hill abduction story.
Wow.
1963. Probably, you know, people in the 60s that were aware of that first so-called abduction or close encounter, the fourth kind, as I prefer to call it, they'll remember that cover because it was pretty revealing. You know, mm-hmm. Liz Taylor,
mm-hmm.
when she was making The Taming of the Shrew with Richard Burton, and she's got this plunging neckline. There's a photo of it in the book. It's pretty unforgettable, especially to guys like Aykroyd and me, who were probably in our adolescence when that hit the newsstands.
Helping you along with puberty.
Amongst his collection, you're in rarefied air.
I guess.
Yeah.
I'm in his UFO closet, I think.
Well, you talked about disclosure. You were pushing for it, and it's something that we had talked about just a lot on the show recently. It's been in the news everywhere. Here's a quote that you had put in the book, and I really liked it. It says, the UFO matter will be a case where the cover-up is the disclosure, and the disclosure is the cover-up. Deny everything, but let the public sentiment take its course. Let skepticism do our work for us until the truth becomes a common acceptance. That was from General Nathan Twining, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That's a hell of a quote.
That's a hell of a PR strategy, dude.
That it is.
How do you define disclosure? Or what is your idea of... You would say we have disclosure. I know that is a trick question, but what does that look like to you?
Well, I think in reality, it's an official pronouncement from our government and maybe other governments around the world working in concert to say, yes, there are ETs. These are who they are. And then to present someone from the ET world. Some folks seem to think that that's already happened with different presidents like Eisenhower, number one. I don't know. I'm always skeptical when I hear stuff like that. I said, you know, show me the beef, show me the money.
Yeah,
sure.
But I think it has to be an official statement like that with facts, with the beings. A representative,
the proverbial landing on the White House lawn type thing.
Well, yeah, yes and no. You know, from the I keep hearing the term Galactic Federation, which, you know, maybe that's the organization that needs to come forward in unison with governments around the world. And then there needs to be a strategy, like what happens next.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing that intrigued me about Greer's organization, because his whole thing is we don't need the government to contact ET. We can do it ourselves with these protocols, with these working groups, which he's established all over the Western civilization right now, which he likes to call citizen diplomacy. I think that's a really accurate term for it. And I allude to some different social movements like this that force the government's hand. Like, number one, the government denied for years that they did atomic testing on servicemen and women and the public at large, and they denied it. And then in, I think, 94, under the Department of Energy, under Hazel Leary, who happens to be from Minnesota, they came out and they said, yes, here are the files. It's real, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot of money paid out to litigants who've been chasing this disclosure down for, you know, last 4 or 5 decades or more. So that's to me what it looks like.
How disappointing was the release as of late?
Oh, man. I downloaded that damn report 6 times thinking...
Thinking you get more 9 pages?
My computer must be glitching. I thought there were 70 pages to this thing.
Yeah.
It was a major disappointment. And I like to think of it like this. You know, if you think of our government as a publicly held company, which is what our democracy sometimes resembles, the leadership and the board running this business would all be fired for either failing to know what these things are or for consistently failing to reveal what and who they are. I mean, the shareholders would demand that they be thrown out on their tails.
We could go back and forth for, you know, an entire hour just about the developments of the last few years. Obviously, you are considering it the way that we are in the sense that you went back and even rewrote some of your book because of it. So given your definition of disclosure, stuff has been happening since 2017, right? Stuff has been happening, yeah. Meaning we're getting people who wouldn't speak before now speaking, the Tic Tac, all of that, videos, the actual government's releasing videos. All of this stuff didn't happen before. What is your 40,000 foot view of what's happening right now? Does this obviously that's a lot different than somebody showing up with an alien. Do you think this is part of disclosure or something just completely different?
You know, that's a really good question. It's also a really tough question to answer. Sure. I was listening to Grant Cameron's podcast about 6 weeks ago with Danny Sheehan and some other researchers. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with Sheehan, but he's, you know, he helped litigate Watergate, the Pentagon Papers, Wounded Knee, Iran-Contra. This guy's been kind of a hero of mine through most of my life just because he serves the public interest and he's always exposing the government for the nefarious things that it does in our name. And I actually helped recruit him to the SeaSETI Starlight Coalition program. I met him at a UFO conference. I was actually shocked to see him there. I just think, you know, during this podcast, everyone, including Sheehan, kept saying, why is this happening now? That's the number one question the government needs to tell us now. I know, and I think the media stories like in the New York Times that started breaking in 2017 and continued to 2021, I think that put pressure on individuals. I think this Harry Reid thing, you know, Harry's retired senator from Nevada, he's to be celebrated on one level for getting the funding for that thing in Nevada that Robert Bigelow's people took a look at, and that from which Lou Elizondo and Chris Mellon and those guys started to appear on the scene. I don't think it's orchestrated. I think a lot of this stuff is happening in and of itself, but it does make you wonder, why is it happening now? And, you know, I know what Steve Greer thinks because he just made a whole new film about it called Cosmic Hoax, warning that this is a setup to get the funding for Defense Department for space-based weapons and to turn the ETs into the next evil empire, as Reagan once characterized the Soviet Union. So there's that whole line of thinking. Personally, I'm shocked, but I think the most positive thing to come out of it is that the media and now a lot of people are thinking, well, this is a real subject, so maybe I should pay attention. Maybe I should read one of these crazy UFO books. Why not read the Space Fan Club?
That's
you
right.
Know, I wrote this book as much for people who don't know anything about this as for those who are deeply entrenched in the UFO world.
I think that comes through well, because if you do a good job of giving the layman look at insider things. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's a good expression. Let me write that down. I use that on my blog.
There you go, right? It's an interesting time that we're looking at, you know, with this whole disclosure, and it feels, I know a lot of people, and I've said this too, consider the source and what we're going through, and look who the people that have popped back up and now are doing the tours and talking, and Richard Doty and people like that were around pushing the government's made up stories in the past.
Classic disinformation agent who was proud of it. And now he's on our side. I'm having a hard time with
that. That is my thing. And I keep seeing him on all these shows and people are like, this man is, oh, I'm so excited to have him on here. I'm like, why? That is, I just talk about sleeping with the enemy. And I really feel like, I'm not saying that Greer is correct on this. I'm not saying that he's incorrect, but I so many people got disclosure fever, and I think that they need to look at it a little bit more subjectively or give it a better glance than just going, yay, this is all true or not. Consider the source. Yeah.
that's a good lens to look at everything through, really, but also disclosure. You know, Doty, there's a saying, you know, if you join the Marine Corps and you do your hitch and you come out, you're never not a Marine.
Mm-hmm.
And when you say yeah. Semper Fi or Fi or whatever.
Yeah, Semper Fi.
Yeah, they're always Marines. And I think that unfortunately might be true for guys that worked in the intelligence agencies like Doty.
Do you ever retire?
How can you trust him? Even if he's swearing on a Bible and you're like, oh, you know, he makes some claims in Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind film that Greer produced in the last couple of years. He claims that they paid media millions of dollars in cash to shut up about this.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty serious claim. He admits that the military intelligence industrial complex has the ability to hoax abductions and has been doing that since the 50s. I mean, that should be national headlines. I mean, there should be reporters crawling through that looking for documents and calling for hearings, you know, like they had the MK Ultra hearings in the 70s on the dosing of our servicemen and women with LSD, part mm-hmm. of a behavior modification study, which I think went much deeper than that. And I get into that in chapter 3 of the book pretty heavily. You know, that's the kind of stuff that we're going to see, the collateral damage that washes up on the shore with disclosure. All right, these things are real. They're from Alpha Centauri or wherever, and maybe 10 other places in the galaxy. But what about this abduction phenomena?
Oh, I mean,
that's a whole nother can of worms that nobody wants to go to. It's like flypaper. You touch it, you're not going to come unglued from it.
I think one of the most terrifying answers we could get was the answer that we got, which was, yeah, we don't know what these things are. They're up there. We have no idea. If that's the case, holy shit. You know? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
They know what it is. You know, Twining in 47 said in a classified memo, and I'm going to look at my notes here and read this. He said that they were not of this world 74 years ago, quoting, stating that the phenomena reported is something real and not visionary or fictitious. And he went on to describe the extreme rates of climb and other characteristics that precisely match the recorded capabilities of the objects in these recently released Navy footage. So, I mean, this is kind of old hat for anybody who's been paying attention. Here's a guy, and this document was obtained under the Freedom of Information Act. Here's Twining in 47 saying, yeah, they're real, they're here, and, you know, basically putting it out there for people to decide what to do next. It's interesting because in 2012, about 15 different governments around the world just open up their UFO files, including England, although I think England is still sitting on a stack of stuff that'll never be declassified. But our government would never do that, I don't think. Yeah. I think we're kind of leading the embargo, as the truth embargo, as Steve Bassett calls it.
You worked with C. SETI. You talk in the book how SETI itself is listening out there is a waste of money. What's a valid way to look for light, or what should people, either being with organizations that have money or, the lay people that are out and listening to this, what do you think their best bet is? You know, there's stuff out there that is trying Skylab and things like that now that are trying to scan the skies in more of a crowdsourced type thing. Do you have opinion on that, or are we just at the mercy of the government?
You know, the whole SETI thing just seems to me like a colossal waste of money. They don't have any results to show after what, 30 years?
Yeah.
It might be longer.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, that's where the academy is. We're using radio signals, which I think is probably not something that the ETs are looking at too hard. I think they have other technological spectrums that they utilize, including consciousness. And there's a lot of cases where you can, where that's illustrated. One of my favorites is one from the 70s in Indiana or Illinois, out on an interstate freeway, where an object was literally stalling out traffic along the freeway because it was hovering over trucks and cars. And one trucker got on his CB radio and said, "Hey, ET, if you got your ears on, let's talk." And this object moved right over his right over his truck and followed him down the highway for a bit. And then there's another case like that.
Breaker 19.
So they obviously have capabilities of listening and maybe even telepathically picking up thought waves from people. And that's something that Greer has been on about for a long time in his contact protocols. But, I think citizen diplomacy, citizen sky watches, I think that's the way to go. I think the ETs have kind of washed their hands of governments, that they can't be trusted. They're not going to do what needs to be done. That's why we're going to maybe show ourselves to the layperson on the street or out in the woods or on the interstate highway system.
Well, Martin, that is probably the perfect place to leave it. As we discuss where they're showing themselves to us. Before we go, let us know where they can find your book and any of your other social details.
The best place to buy the book right now is Amazon.com, what I like to call the Internet General Store.
Right.
You can probably get it the same day you order it if you're so inclined. If you go to the book's website, thespacepenclub.com, you can find a handy link to jump to order it on Amazon. I'm trying to blog there at least once or twice a week on different subjects related to this very broad discussion. There's some pretty fun blogs on there currently. I'll be posting a couple more yet this week. Social media, I've got a Facebook group that I'm trying to grow called the Space Pen Club, so look for that on Facebook. I'm trying to get my Instagram thing going, but I've got a day job, so my hands have been a little tight on social, but I might enlist my 24-year-old son, who's got more time on his hands than me, to run that. But that'll get populated pretty soon. But I wanted to thank you guys. This has been fun. And as I told Brent coming into this, I said, how could I not do a show called Hysteria 51?
I told him I'm so excited when people get awesome. Our name. That's amazing.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, Martin, this has been a pleasure. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
And Nation, we are going to take our final break, and we'll be back right after this.
John, are your warts the wartiest?
They are the wartiest.
I knew it. C-Bud owes me $15 now.
Fuck.
I didn't expect to hear that phrase today. I certainly didn't expect to hear it twice.
I've never heard that before. Is that
I hadn't either. I'm just saying that.
Yeah, no, I was. That was awesome. I was like, that's a really.
I enjoyed the conversation. Admittedly, most of the things that he talks about, both in the book and some of the things he talked about here, I much more think of as thought experiments rather than. Aspects of reality, but nonetheless, he approaches it with a kind of open approach, and it's fun for folks like me to at least engage with them as thought experiments.
Well, yeah, and the point of it is, if it's a thought experiment or not, We're trying to get to the bottom of that. And he's been at the forefront of that for a long time, talking to former presidents and working with Greer and other people. If you look into the book, he's worked with the who's who of ufology throughout the years and been at the forefront of it. So that's he's got an impressive resume. And I agree with him 100%. I'm ready for the disclosure where they go. And this is Gleepclop. And he's here to tell us how we get into the Galactic Federation or whatever the hell it is, instead of this cold trickle of disclosure that people are calling it. Yeah, I agree with his. If that's what he wants, well, by God, I agree.
We didn't spend much time on that, but if that's what he was implying, meaning that what we're getting now is a lot of things, but it's not disclosure, I would actually agree with that. I don't think there's some master plan by, you know, we're going to leak to the New York Times. We're going to have David Fravor come out and say things about Tic Tacs. And, you know, it's all part of this master plan. I don't believe that.
Or if it is a master plan, it's a master plan of disinformation in order to make more money, because that is right up the government's sleeve in my book. So I don't know. You know, my problem is they don't pay me to make those decisions. I just get my shield check every month and cash it and stay in my yacht.
Take your orders.
You know, yeah.
Take your orders.
Well, you know, I'm learning how to blink with my third lens and lick my eyes clean from my reptilian overlord. So I got that going for me.
Just give me a sweet taste of that sweet, sweet adrenochrome.
I just need a daddy needs a hit. Come on, baby. If they want to tell us, the listeners at home, about the book, what they like about it, what they liked about Martin, about what they see as what disclosure would be, which I think would be a really fun conversation to have on Hysteria Nation. I just gave it away, John, but where can they tell us those things?
I would suggest sending smoke signals. But if that doesn't work, go to Hysteria Nation. It is our Facebook discussion group. You just go to Facebook and search Hysteria Nation.
It is very dry out there and there's a lot of fires. We're going to say skip the smoke signals for a few months right now is my takeaway.
Carrier pigeons then. Fine. Right.
While you're on Facebook, don't forget to go to facebook.com/Hysteria51Pod. That is our regular page. You can also hop on Patreon, patreon.com/Hysteria51. That is where you can find Up All Nights, Mad Blurry Hysterias, all sorts of fun shenanigans. Also, tweet to us at Hysteria51Pod or at John. He is GofoLite1, GofoLite1. I am at the Brent Hand because I am the Brent Hand. Easy to find.
It's safe to say, I agree. It's safe to say they broke the mold. The question is to why they broke the mold.
Oh, we all know this. Perfection is perfected. And why? I mean, you don't even keep going. Voicemail.
Oh, God, don't do it again.
773-669-7277. Again, 773-669-7277. John, let's listen to two. We got a little time.
All right.
All right, so number one coming up.
Hey, this is Jeff from Austria. Me and my wife love to listen to you and keep up. I hope to hear you guys a little more often, and we hope to hear an episode about UFO involvement in Europe. Let us know.
Sweet. Austria.
Nice.
Home of the former governator or whatever you want to call him. Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Well, we have done a lot of Europe. I don't know when, I don't have the date on that one, but we will always be doing more Europe. And I actually have some of those scheduled coming up, not in front of me, so I can't tell you the topics, but we're going to be doing some more European based shenanigans. So that's awesome.
I don't know if you know this, but the listener that just left that voicemail is better known as the Muscles from Brussels.
Even though they said they're from Austria, that was just a cunning ruse.
It was, right.
All right, here we go. One more.
Hey, I keep meaning to leave a message, but I figured by the time I actually left this message, you guys probably would have just deleted voicemail because nobody uses voicemail anymore, and I would just end up having some 10-year-old girl's new cell phone number. First, I just... So really the only thing I wanted to say is, C-Bot, please stop sending me dead cats.
No.
last one got delivered to a neighbor, and that's not cool.
Good.
That was on purpose.
So, now I have the restraining order, and, C-Bot, I just wanted to say,
That's it.
All right.
C-Bot, I just wanted to say...
A quick note to... all of you listeners, if you call and leave us a voicemail, say your name so we can give you credit.
Unless you don't want to say your name. You know what? Yeah, it's a choose your own adventure, John.
Also, a quick note to that listener. We have tried the whole restraining order thing. Because he's not considered a sentient being, the court won't issue one.
Loophole, bitches.
Well, at least he's consistent.
He's something. He is something.
So don't forget, let us know what you guys got going on for disclosure. What do you want to hear? What do you want to say? Well, how do you feel about the report that we just received? And we will talk about that on an upcoming episode, a little more in depth. I've been kind of waiting to see what's going to come out, and we'll find out here in the next coming weeks.
Or if anything, I mean, fuck, nothing's come out.
Yeah.
The report didn't, I mean, there was nothing to it.
Well, no, nine pages of nothingness is, nine pages of nothingness. That's what they should have titled the entire thing. So anyway, we'll see.
Like this pod, 90, we should rename the podcast 90 Minutes of Nothingness.
With that said, I've been Brent.
I've been John.
He's been Conspiracy Bot.
Stay woke, meet sex.
It was terrible. It was just terrible. I'll never get over it as long as I live.
That's it for another edition of Hysteria 51. John and Brent will be back next week with yet more of the unexplained, the unexplored, and the unheard of. Oh, if it's unheard of, how will they know about it? Anyway, if you want to suggest a topic, give us your thoughts, or just make fun of Conspiracy Bot, that's my favourite, join us in our Facebook discussion group, Hysteria Nation. Just log on to Facebook and search Hysteria Nation, or you can always tweet us at Hysteria51Pod.
You've been listening to a fourth-hand joint.